From Ground Zero Radio, this is Democracy Now in Exile.
In the very first hour of that beacon of globalization, the North American Free Trade Agreement, January 1st, 1994, so it began the Zapatista Rebellion in Mexico.
The war against oblivion. Where do the Zapatistas stand today? We'll hear a talk by journalist and author John Ross. All that and more coming up. Welcome to the War and Peace Report, broadcasting just blocks from where the towers of the World Trade Center once stood. I'm Amy Goodman. Happy New Year. On January 1st, 1994, 8 years ago, the Zapatistas staged an uprising in the southern Mexican state of Chiapas. The rebellion happened in the first hours of the North American Free Trade Agreement, or NAFTA. The uprising provided a tremendous boost and inspiration to the then burgeoning movement against corporate globalization. Early last year, the Zapatistas caravaned from the jungles of Chiapas to the heart of Mexico City, retracing the steps of Emiliano Zapata. Today, in the post-September 11th world, the Zapatistas, like many groups and people across the globe, face a new reality. As we enter this new year, people around the world are feeling the impact of the Bush administration's so-called war on terror. As we've said often on this program, a man who is not elected president has declared war on the world. In addition to the carnage in Afghanistan that has seen thousands of civilians killed by cluster bombs and the Pentagon's ill-titled 15,000-pound daisy cutter bombs, this war has given governments around the world virtual blank checks to smash dissent, restrict individual freedoms, and in some areas of the globe to occupy countries and territories, all in the name of fighting terror. Here in the United States, the government has pushed through repressive laws and decrees aimed at quashing dissent as well. The line between the government and corporate media is at its most invisible state, perhaps ever. But still, movements and peoples around the world remain determined to struggle for freedom. The Zapatistas are one such movement. We turn now to a talk by author and journalist John Ross. He's appeared frequently on this program, reporting from Mexico on the Zapatista movement, globalization, the so-called free trade agreements, and their effects on poor and working people in Mexico. He's written several books about Mexico, among them The War Against Oblivion, The Zapatista Chronicles, and Rebellion from the Roots. This is John Ross on the Zapatistas.
You know, I've seen a transformation in this period of time in these last 2 months that I've been on tour. When I first set out, you know, people were still really shell-shocked about 9/11 and the war, and people were focused and outraged about the bombing and what to do, and were putting the issues that they've worked on for so long to one side, no? We all have to focus our energies on the war, no? I know in Madison, at one point, Madison, always the anti-war center of this country, few people came out to hear what I had to say because people were just too busy focusing on the war. And I think that's been a motion that we've seen all around the country, no? But in the last couple of weeks, I've noticed that there's been much more integration in those issues. We did a rally in New York City that was quite good. On sweatshops day after Thanksgiving, show that, you know, buy your Christmas gifts, you go buy all these goods that are manufactured, so to speak, in sweatshops in Central America and Mexico and other countries around the world. And that was a no sweatshop, no war demonstration, and the connections were made. And I've seen that in recent rallies that I've participated in that dealt with indigenous rights, dealt with the preservation of forests. Those issues that we've been working on for a long time, we can't put those issues aside. We have to be able to figure out how they relate to the war, because they do relate to the war. This war is not a special circumstance. It's the way the ruling class in this country operates, no? And we've got to be able to bring our constituencies and integrate our struggles, not sacrificing what we have to say, but figuring out how we can bring them to the anti-war movement at the same time and bring people from the anti-war movement to our own constituencies and the issues that we're working on. Mm-hmm. And I think it provides us with a really important opportunity, a kind of window now to talk to people about how U.S., so to speak, foreign policy dominates the world, has disaffected the world, as the very conservative bishop of San Cristobal de las Casas said at Sunday night mass not a month ago, Felipe Arismendi, a person that is a conservative who was called in by the Vatican to replace Don Samuel Ruiz, said that, you know, maybe this will be an opportunity for the people of the U.S. to reflect upon why the world hates us so much, no? And this was a conservative bishop in San Cristobal, no? And so if they're looking at it that way, you think that, you know, I think we can understand that this does present us with this opportunity to talk to folks about why things happen in the world the way they do. Okay. The pitch black night suddenly came alive with darting shadows. The slap of rubber boots against the slick pavement echoed throughout the hushed neighborhoods on the periphery of town. Sleepy chuchos stirred in their patios, stretched and bayed, the howling catching from block to block, barrio to barrio. Across the narrow Puente Blanco, down the rutted Centenary Diagonal, up General Utria from the Marketplace District, dark columns jogged in military cadence. With their features canceled behind ski masks and bandanas that left their collective breath hanging in the still mountain air like vapors from a past many Mexicans do not wish to recognize as being very present, the sin rostros, the without faces of the Zapatista Army of National Liberation advanced on the center of the city of San Cristobal de las Casas, the throne of the Mayan highlands of the state of Chiapas, Mexico's most southern state, most impoverished state, and arguably its most Indian state, in the very first hour of that beacon of globalization, the North American Free Trade Agreement, January 1st, 1994. So it began the Zapatista rebellion in Mexico. No. Fast forward a bit to all the January 1sts that have occurred since then and will occur again this January 1st when we have gone to Chiapas to mark that first moment of the uprising so many years ago now, 8 years this year. And we'll go to Ovintiquina Highlands, a cultural center that the Yelenas established many years ago, or down to the most public outpost of the Yelen in the jungle, that town with the haunting name of La Realidad, the reality. And we'll hear the comandante speak of La Guerra contra el Olvido, the war against olvido. You can translate olvido a number of ways. I think the most popular way is to say forgetfulness. But this is not the kind of forgetfulness that says I left my book in the cafe or my glasses in the classroom or something behind, tie a string around your finger. The olvido that these Yelen talks about, that the comandantes talk about, is an olvido that erases the past, that obliterates the past, that eliminates the history of the resistances of the peoples of these Americas, because that history, those resistances, are not very helpful to the people that would globalize this planet from the top down, no? And so they talk about an olvido that would obliterate memories of the Mexican Revolution, 1910 through 1919, that first great social uplift from the bottom, uprising from the bottom of Mexican society, landless indigenous peasants on the move behind an Indian leader, his name, Emiliano Zapata. Emiliano Zapata was a Nahuatl Indian. The reason he was the leader in his pueblo is because he spoke both Spanish and Nahuatl, contemporary Aztec. The land grants for which he fought for his village, Anenquilco, were written in Nahuatl, in an Indian language. The Mexican Revolution, that revolution which set the style, the pace for revolution in our hemisphere and our Americas, was essentially an Indian revolution from the bottom. And it is the memory of that revolution that they would obliterate, that they want to eliminate, because, as I say, the rebellions of the peoples of this world are not helpful to those that want to dominate the planet, corporatize the planet from the top down. An oblivion that would obliterate the struggles of the indigenous peoples of this continent for the last half millennium. You know, this past October 12th, we celebrated the 500th, we marked the 509th anniversary of the so-called conquest of the Americas by the Europeans, by the people that came from without. Here we still, I think, call it Columbus Day, whatever, in honor of this gentleman that stumbled into the Americas. In Latin America, in Mexico in specific, it is the day of indigenous resistance and remains the day of indigenous resistance, no? An oblivion that would obliterate 57 distinct indigenous nations in Mexico, 63 distinct indigenous languages, not dialects, not idioms, but complete language systems that would obliterate those language systems. What happens when a language goes away, when it dies, when it is obliterated, when it is consigned to oblivion? We lose the way to name the divine and human things on this planet, no? I read this poem this afternoon and I love it, and I'm going to read it again if I can find it. It's a translation from the Aztec by the great translator of Aztec poetry, Miguel León Portillo. And it's what happens when a language dies. And this is really at the nub of what the Zapatista Rebellion is all about. Making sure that these are living languages, not preserving relics from the past, but making sure that their languages can survive in the future. We forget the past. We are doomed to serve out the future. Cuando muere una lengua, I'm going to read it first in Spanish and then I'll read it in English. Cuando muere una lengua, las cosas divinas, estrellas, sol y luna, las cosas humanas, pensar y sentir, no se refleja ya en eso espejo. Cuando muere una lengua, todo lo que hay en el mundo, mares y ríos, animales y plantas, ni se piensan, ni se pronuncian con atisbos y sonidos que no existan ya. Entonces, se cierra a todos los pueblos del mundo una ventana, una puerta, un asomarse de modo distinto a las cosas divinas y humanas en cuanto a ser y vida en la tierra. Cuando muere una lengua, sus palabras de amor, entonación de dolor y querencia, tal vez viejos cantos, relatos, discursos, plegarias, nadie cual fueren alcanzará a repetir. Cuando muere una lengua, ya mucho ha muerto y muchos pueden morir. Espejos para siempre quebrados, sombra de voces para siempre acalladas. La humanidad se empobrece. When a language dies, the divine things, stars, sun, moon, the human things to think and to feel no longer are reflected in this mirror. When a language dies, all that there is in this world, seas and rivers, animals and plants, do not think of them, do not pronounce their names, do not look for them. They do not exist now. Then the window and the door will be closed up for all the peoples of the world. No more will they be shown a different way to name the divine and human things, which is what it means to be and to live on the earth. When a language dies, its words of love, its intonations of pain and caring, perhaps the old songs, the old stories, speeches, the prayers, no one, no matter whom, will be able to repeat them again. When a language dies, then many have died, and many more will die soon. Mirrors forever broken, shadows of voices forever silenced. Humanity grows poorer when a language dies. I'm trying to keep those languages alive, you know? So how does this relate to the war, no? How does this relate to 9/11? Let's take a second to kind of talk about how 9/11 appeared in Chiapas. I was there not long, maybe 3 weeks after 9/11. And I was specifically concerned about what the men, for example, the Tzotzil men from San Juan Chumula who come down to San Cristobal every day and stand in front of the Electra store on Insurgentes, the main drag in San Cristobal, looking at 30 television sets, these banks of television sets. What were they seeing when they saw the planes plow into the buildings over and over and over again on Mexican television? No? I think it's a difficult question to ask what a people saw, what they think. In many communities, they saw different things. I think in the evangelical communities, they saw the end of the world coming. It's interesting that the years 2010 through 2012 on the Mayan calendar marked the end of this Mayan world and the beginning of the next one, no? So maybe people saw that as well. I think in many communities, such as Obentik and Aldama, which are autonomous municipalities, or part of the autonomous municipality scene, where people were watching this on television, what they saw was that the giant, the colossus of the north, the norte, el norte, those powerful people were not quite so powerful as they were before. I think all of the South, not just of Mexico, but all over the world, people saw that indeed the giant, the US, was not invincible anymore. What does that mean? I think they take that into account. They're still, according to a good friend, Gustavo Castro, maybe many of you know him, Gustavo, who runs a think tank in Chiapas, says that when they go into the communities now, that people ask them for a video of the planes crashing into the World Trade Center, no? They're assimilating those images, no? And what that means in terms of seeing the U.S. As no longer quite the dominating power that it was before, I think they're weighing. They're trying to figure out what that means, whether that benefits them or whether it doesn't benefit them, no? Let me read you a poem that I wrote after that visit to San Cristobal. This is a poem that, you know, the Zapatistas were bombed. In the first 12 days of their uprising back in January of 1994, bombs were dropped on Zapatista communities. We were up on that big mountain right outside of San Cristobal, if any of you know the terrain, Maria Auxiliadora, when a U.S. missile crashed into the forest maybe 50 feet from where we were, you know. It's an interesting moment. The women in the town were all crouched down in a ditch, and one of the women pulled out her voting card, you know, and she held it up to the sky, and she said, somos del PRI, we're from the PRI, as if that could fend off the bombs, you know. But it was a U.S. missile fired from a Swiss fighter, a pilota's plane. Down in the jungle, helicopters dropped bombs on communities and settlements in and around Altamirano, down around the Ejido Nuevo San Carlos. Several people were killed. This had never happened before. So that gives you some context for what I'm going to read here. The Zapatistas have been bombed before. They know what that means. This poem is called In Tzotzil. Tzotzil is the language and the peoples of the Highland Maya. Tzotz means bat, These are the people that were born in the white caves above Sacomchin de los Pobres, este San Andres Larenza, the place where those peace talks took place for many years.
You're listening to John Ross, and we're going to go to that poem in a minute, but we're going to break for stations to identify themselves. John Ross is the author of The War Against Oblivion, The Zapatista Chronicles. The Zapatistas rose up 8 years ago on January 1st, 1994. Stay with us. Zapatista hymn, written by one of the women comandantes sung at protests and marches in Chiapas. You are listening to the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman as we go back to John Ross, author and journalist, author of The War Against Oblivion, The Zapatista Chronicles. He was about to recite a poem.
Pobres, este San Andres Larenza, the place where those peace talks took place for many years, a social power spot. So in Tzotzil is a language as well as the people, the Tzotzil people, the people of the bat. On a green hillside south of Ocosingo, a campesino in rubber boots aims his single shot 22 high and curses the deep blue sky that has taken his only son and daughter. Together the family had gone to cut the sweet cane when the plane came back and dropped its death bombs. The bultos hit the ground like an evil kiss, the concussion knocking him into mindless oblivion, and when he awoke, Rosa was bubbling blood from her lips, and young Agustin was cradled limply in her lap by the side of the Nuevo San Carlos River, where such a thing had never fallen from the deep blue sky before. It was his own Black Tuesday, and in his broken heart, the seed of jihad germinated. In San Cristobal, the Tzotziles stand in the street staring at the banks of shiny television screens, the jumbo jets plowing into the crumbling skyscrapers over and over and over again. What are they thinking? That it is just a movie? That it is the end of the world, or maybe the beginning of the next one? That it is none of their business, or all of their business, because now the cacciones, the white men, will come again to tear apart the horizon. War has lacerated these small, wise men and women, forced them into the caves to eat weeds and offal. Their cousins have been killed over and over and over again, but not on the TV. Is it really a movie, or is the movie house being broken apart by advanced missile systems, tomahawks, guided by cowards at the controls, 10,000 miles from their targets, too far away to count the body parts, or hear the wails of lamentations, or smell the blood? The corn is tall enough now to be bombed. the river full of secret germs, the wind is salted with the worms of fear. The societies have known war before, have tasted its rotting fruit, suffered its opened wounds, picked up their children, and they were dead. There is a fire in my heart, the mother said. If I could reach the one who killed my son, I would eat him until he was dead, the mother said. The Palestinian mother said, in Tzotzil. In Tzotzil. Let me tell you a bit about Mexico and the war, and I think I need to begin by saying this is not Mexico's war. Mexico is a neutral country. Mexico does not involve itself in international conflicts until it is pushed to the utmost limit. Mexico operates on a diplomatic principle, the Estrada Doctrine, which says that they do not endorse intervention in any other country in the world. It's a way that the government has used sometimes to keep human rights groups from probing into Mexican abuses of its own citizenry. But the guiding principle of Mexican diplomacy is the Estrada document, non-intervention. And by that sense, the Mexican people, most of their Congress people, perhaps not their president and their foreign minister, don't view this as being Mexico's war. And I think it's important to understand that when we look at how the South itself reacts to this war. The South, no? The South in terms of that contradiction, South-North. No? Most of the world seems to operate always on this East-West bias. No? No one takes a look or cares much about what the people of the South think about what is done in the North. But let's be clear that this is not Mexico's war. Now, the U.S. does not love Mexico. George W. 5 days before 9/11, welcomed the Mexican president, Vicente Fox, formerly the president of the Coca-Cola Corporation, to the White House, where he said, putting his arm around Vicente Fox, that Mexico is our most important foreign relation. 6 days later, after 9/11, you couldn't find Mexico on the map in the White House war room, for sure. I mean, Mexico, or the U.S. does not love Mexico, but it certainly loves Mexican oil. And I think that that's really what we have to look at in terms of what the outfall of this war and a protracted war against terrorism, it can bring to Mexico. Mr. Fox has begun to implement a plan that he calls the Puebla to Panama plan. And we're talking about Puebla, you know, it's in Mexico, it goes to the Mexican border, then it goes down a little bit further through Central America, takes us all the way to Panama, and presumably after the plan Puebla to Panama, the plan Colombia kicks in, no? And that takes care of the rest of what's down there, except there might be some more territories down below Colombia, and then we can look at the Free Trade Agreement of the Americas, the FTAA, as taking, they got it all planned out, no? Puebla to Panama, Plan Colombia, FTAA, that's their plan for this hemisphere, no? Now, the Plan Puebla to Panama, I don't know about the Panama part because I don't know much about how the Central Americans have reacted to this imposition by the Mexican president upon their own economies and their own forests and their own natural resources. But within Mexico and southern Mexico, the idea is to bring transnational investment, specifically in the energy sectors, to the south of Mexico, the impoverished, resource-rich southern Mexico, a Mexico that is a heavily Indian enclave from Puebla all the way down to the Guatemala border. And I think it is the attempts to implement this plan to bring transnational capital into energy exploitation in the South that we need to watch out for. Wars need a lot of oil to fuel them, and that oil is going to be used for a long time. If these planes keep flying, every plane that's up there needs more oil. No. George W. has also announced that he wants to fill the U.S. Strategic Reserve, which Mexico usually is responsible for supplying, up to the brim. That's never been done before, but filling out the U.S. Strategic Reserve. So on these, and the other aspect, I think, is trying to lessen dependence on the producers in the Middle East, Saudi Arabia in particular, about 13% of the U.S. oil basket. Between Mexico and Venezuela, about a quarter of the U.S. petroleum imports are generated. No, Venezuela is a problem for George W. Hugo Chavez has made a lot of noise about not supporting this war, and I think that we will see in the not-so-distant future the kind of attempts to destabilize the Chavez regime in Venezuela that has been such a benchmark of U.S. diplomacy in all of Latin America. In Mexico, I think Mr. Bush and Mr. Fox have a certain, how did they say that, chemistry together, you know? They both are fake ranchers. That's one thing they have in common, you know? George Bush is not a rancher. You know, George Bush had to buy a rancher after he became Texas governor. It's mandatory for the Texas governor to have a ranch. And Mr. Fox, the man with the cowboy boots and the Stetson hat, grows cauliflower and broccoli on his farms in the Bajio of Guanajuato. It's not exactly get along little doggies, you know, when you're exporting broccoli and cauliflower to the U.S., you know. And anyway, I don't know about this broccoli thing because George W.'s father always hated broccoli, so. But there is this chemistry, you know, between those guys that first time they ever met, you know, Vicente Fox brought a pair of boots and he gave the boots to George Bush. Well, the boots were kind of the symbol of Vicente Fox's campaign, you know. He stomped through the country, stopping on the critters of the prey and the varmints, you know. He didn't mention, however, that the Fox Brothers boot factory in León, Guanajuato is one of the largest boot factories in Mexico, you know. So this is kind of a logo advertisement. This guy's a marketer. He sold Coca-Cola to the Mexican people for 16 years during the 60s and the 70s when Coca-Cola was considered throughout the world to be the most devastating symbol of U.S. imperialism, no? So, you know, let's be clear that what comes out of Vicente Fox's mouth is pretty much selling Coca-Cola. Whether he calls it FTAA, whether he calls it Plan Panama, to Puebla de Panama, whatever he calls it, he's selling you Coca-Cola. He is a marketer. That's how he became president of Mexico. He marketed himself into power. So there's a lot of resource in southern Mexico. There's a lot of oil. The most important land-based deposits are in the state of Tabasco and in certain parts of Chiapas. Along with the oil, there's a lot of natural gas. In the Zapatista zone, I think that's what we're looking at more than anything else, natural gas. It's a little bit high up to be down at the very bottom of the oil basin that runs into Guatemala along the border in the Petén. No. There's a lot of mineral wealth underneath the soil, in the subsoil. Indian peoples and mestizo farmers on ejidos own 80% of the forest lands in Mexico. 80% of the forest. They've lost their timber rights very often. Very often the timber is just stolen from them and cut down. But we've seen since NAFTA was enacted in 1994, many a transnational timber giant from the U.S. enter Mexico and start cutting down the trees. No. And we've just had an important battle in the state of Guerrero with the Boise Cascade Corporation, who went home with their tails between their legs. So, but it's good, but we can talk about that because there's some bad aspects to it too. But that's what the transnationals are looking at when they look at the PPP. They're looking at what lies beneath Indian lands. And in a war, what lies between Indian lands is more needed than ever by those people that would wage war. Now, the Zapatistas specifically have been battling for a long time for an Indian rights law that would indeed grant the Indian communities, the Indian nations in Mexico, 57 distinct indigenous nations, autonomy. That means control over their own lands, control over their own agrarian policies, control over the exploitation of natural resources. The Indian rights law that the Zapatistas negotiated with the government in 1996 was a benchmark agreement, probably the most important agreement revising the relationship of indigenous peoples to their government. It granted them autonomy. It meant that they could decide their own destiny. They could decide their own bilingual educational program. They could control their own justice system. They could elect their village officials by the by that principle that the Zapatistas hold so dear, mandar obedeciendo, governing by obeying the will of the people, serving the people in the communities. And then those majority indigenous counties could affiliate into autonomous regions that would elect candidate or would elect candidates to state and local congresses, no? A system that would grant the indigenous peoples of Mexico territory, not just land. The international definition of what an indigenous nation is that it has territory, it has habitat, it is a nation, no? And that law has gone through a lot of changes, and sooner or later in this presentation, I'm going to show you a video about the march that the EZLN conducted last year up to Mexico City in defense of this indigenous rights law. Again, probably the most important landmark agreement between Indian peoples and their government ever enacted or ever negotiated in Latin America, because it was never enacted. President of Mexico, Ernesto Zedillo, when he was president, vetoed the law on the grounds that precisely this law would allow the Indian peoples to secede from Mexico, to take with them their oil, their natural gas, and their timber. And the Zapatistas said nothing could be further from the truth. We want to be Mexican citizens, first-class Mexican citizens, but on our own terms, our own terms being autonomy, nationhood, indigenous nations within the Mexican context, not outside the Mexican context. This battle has gone on for a long time. The autonomy provisions of the Indian rights law would indeed allow all Indian peoples to deny transnational access to oil, to natural gas, to minerals in the subsoil, to the timberlands. It doesn't necessarily say that they can't, that the Mexican government can't exploit that oil, but that the indigenous communities will themselves have the final word as to whether or not they can enter into the communities and do this work. A lot of it has to do with mitigation funds, a lot of it has to do with the kind of compensation that indigenous people would gain from allowing their lands to be exploited. But the autonomy provisions of the Indian rights law are definitely an impediment to the transnational exploitation of the south of Mexico, to getting at this oil that they're going to need for their war. And the resistance that the indigenous law, that the autonomy law indicates, it has been challenged by the Mexican government. Congress refused to pass this law. We'll show a video about the Zapatistas' historic march last spring from the Chiapas Highlands up to Mexico City, where they went before the Congress of the country and insisted that the Congress pass this law, and of course they were turned down. The law was gutted. All of those provisions I talked about, those autonomy provisions, were taken out of the law. That struggle still goes on. And when and if we get a legitimate indigenous rights law in Mexico that allows the indigenous nations this freedom to control their own destiny, we're going to see this barrier thrown up to transnational exploitation. Now, the Mexican government is not going to take that lying down. They have 30,000 troops, 36,000 troops within the conflict zone at this moment. And when indigenous people begin to say, no, you can't get out our oil, we're going to see a lot more troops sent into these areas. We're going to, in fact, I think, see the Zapatistas with their masks, no, categorized as terrorists, as all social movements are being tarred these days, no? That, in fact, if you resist the powers that be, if you try and control your own destiny, all of a sudden you're a terrorist now. That's the way you're painted. So I think those are, you know, a series of events that we can see following after 9/11. Attempts to get at the oil in the indigenous zones, resistance on the part of the Indian peoples, and the Mexican government in alliance with the U.S. taking orders from the White House, calling the Zapatistas terrorists, and using that as a pretext to go in and take over the land and take over the oil.
John Ross, author and journalist. We're going to come back to the speech he recently gave. Among his books, The War Against Oblivion, The Zapatista Chronicles, and Rebellion from the Roots. If you'd like to get more information on the videotape of his speech, as well as the two that we'll be playing in our second hour, Noam Chomsky and Edward Said, we're putting them all together for a New Year's special two-hour video. You can call 1-800-926-3921. That's 1-800-926-3921. Going to a music break. CD compiled by the FCLN, the Zapatista Civil Front in Mexico. You are listening to the War and Peace Report. That music featured Subcomandante Marcos as we go back to author and journalist John Ross on the Zapatistas.
One other consequence, I think, of 9/11 is that it marginates the struggles of indigenous peoples in the South. As I mentioned, the world has turned on, again, this East-West bias. News from the South is sparing. We don't hear much. The Zapatista cause has only occasionally been news, and we can, I think, expect to see less news from the South, less news from the Indian struggles in the South as this war on this East-West bias continues. No? And that gives us a certain obligation to make sure that this rebellion doesn't go away. There's lots of ways in which we can support the Zapatista cause, get the word out, and let people know that this struggle continues to exist. And just some of the ways that this can happen, I think, are in terms of getting the news out, finding out what's going on in Chiapas, going to Chiapas yourself, learning about what this struggle is, all the way to buying fair trade coffee that comes from the Zapatista Autonomous Zone, that comes from Mugbeats, where several Zapatista autonomias have come together to form a cooperative that is now selling fair trade coffee here in the U.S. So there's lots of different ways that we can bring the Zapatista cause to the attention of folks who are totally focused on other issues at this moment. No? We've got to be able to give them a voice here as much as we've got to be able to give the struggle for the forest, for the struggle of indigenous rights, for the struggles against discrimination and for affirmative action here. All of those struggles that people have said, you know, put them aside, we can only focus on the war right now. That's not true. We have to focus on this wide range of issues that we've all been working on for a great number of years, and not let the war dominate what we have to say, but use this window of opportunity, this war, to integrate our struggles with the anti-war movement. Build that anti-war movement from the bottom. And I think that I take that from a guy that was, the first guy that went to jail from the Bay Area in San Francisco back in 1964, when another war began in the east of the world, in Vietnam, and they wrapped me up at several demonstrations and took me before the federal courts and said, well, you have torn up your draft card, you are going to jail. And I spent a year in jail, getting to jail on the day that the Gulf of Tonkin invasion began, 1964, the first days of August 4th of 1964. I was a little bit ahead of the curve, but we saw that war coming. And I'm telling you guys out here, there's another big war out there, and it's already underway, and we're going to see more of this. We've got to be able to deal with the war as well as live our lives and deal with the issues that we've been dealing with for a long time. No. So getting the word out about the Zapatista struggle is, I think, important. No. What do I want to say? I want to say that this is a struggle in Chiapas that deals very much with memory. I began by talking about what happens when a language dies. And this is a struggle that is about the past as much as it's about the present, as much as it's about the future. This is a struggle in which we can't eliminate the past. There was a world before 9/11, no? And maybe that world goes back a long ways, no? But maybe we can think about the world that existed before 9/11, on another 9/11, 18 years ago in 1973 in Santiago, Chile, when the bombs dropped on the Moneda Palace, murdering Salvador Allende, the president of Chile, and taking with him 4,600 people disappeared and dead in Chile, engineered by the White House, engineered by Henry Kissinger, no, on another 9/11. As many people died in Chile as died in the World Trade Center. I don't want to get into a pissing match about body counts, but there was a world before 9/11, 2001, and we can just go back to that other 9/11 back there in 1973, no? And there was a world before that too. There was a world on August 6, 1946, when the US dropped its death bombs on Hiroshima and later on Nagasaki, taking with it 300,000 people. The world changed for the Japanese people just as the world changed for the people that were in the World Trade Center that day. The world changed for the Salvadoran people when 800 people were massacred at Masote. The world changed for the Vietnamese people when 3 million Vietnamese died under US bombs during the war in Vietnam, no? The world has changed for a lot of people, and the world changed for the Indian peoples of the Americas. Let's take a date, Good Friday, 1519, when Hernan Cortez and 300 white guys showed up from Europe, met a band of Totonaco Indians on the beach at the mouth of the Zampala River in Veracruz, and proceeded to beat them and enslave them. The beginning of the struggle for Indian rights in Mexico. On that day, there were between 12.5 million and 25 million indigenous peoples living in Mexico when the first census was taken 160 years later in 1680. There were less than a million Indians left. 12 million people died in that Holocaust, a Holocaust twice the size of the European Holocaust, and vastly more deadly and devastating than what happened at the WTC on 9/11. So the world existed a long time before 9/11, 2001. We can't let those memories get away. We have to remember what happened in the past in order to know where we're going in the future. No. I want to read a poem, and then maybe we'll show the video after that, another poem. It's a poem that deals with this question of memory, you know, and it's the title poem to a new volume of poetry that I've just put out, Against Amnesia, of which there are precious few copies. Unfortunately, most of them are still in Mexico. This is a poem that takes its inspiration from the massacre of 46 Tzotzil Indians at Actial, December 22nd, 1997, 3 days before Christmas. A massacre of Tzotzil Indians engineered, financed, armed by the Mexican military and the Mexican government. Paramilitary troops were trained all that summer to inflict terror upon the Zapatista bases, to so terrorize them that they would no longer affiliate with the EZLN. And on that terrible morning of December 22nd, 60 paramilitaries come down a hillside in the county of Chenalhó in the highlands of Chiapas and enter a community, a refugee community named Actial, where there are people known as las abejas, the bees, honey gatherers, and coffee growers. They have settled there because they've been burnt out of their communities by members of the Institutional Revolutionary Party, the PRI, the longest ruling political dynasty in the known universe up until then. No. They are, these paramilitaries are Tzotzil Indians too. It is the plan of the Mexican government to put Tzotzil Indians upon Tzotzil Indians, to have them kill each other. It was part of a counterinsurgency plan called the Chiapas Strategy Plan, promulgated by the Mexican military, the 7th Military Region in Chiapas, 1994, and carried out step by step by General Mario Renon Castillo, a graduate of the Center for Special Forces in Fort Bragg, North Carolina, who graduated from the Center for Special Forces magnum cum laude with a degree in counterinsurgency. This was an act of counterinsurgent terror. No. And they're going to try and tell us it never happened. No. If what is we've seen happen in the Southern Cone, where I worked for a number of years, is true, where they now have these commissions of oblivion, commissions of reconciliation that grant amnesty to the generals that threw 30,000 Argentinians into the Atlantic Ocean. They have been amnestied, the generals there. It is against the law to remember now in the Southern Cone of Latin America. So I was coming down from Ovantique, this cultural center in the highlands with, I'm a reporter, I was coming down the hill with a photographer, a Chilean who began to tell me how Pinochet's fascists had killed his father. Began to think about what memory is, how he remembered, but how the rest of us don't always remember these things. This poem is called Against Amnesia. Coming down from the green muddy mountains where the gringos had gone to build with the Zapatistas, the autonomous rebel high school, shovel by shovel and grain by grain, the Chileno photographer began to tell me how his father had been tortured to death by Pinochet's fascists, how they had broken his own ribs, his legs, hot-wired his testicles, and touched him tenderly with lighted cigarettes. They learned their techniques from the pinchy Nazis, he said, matter-of-factly whipping around the hairpin turns, the dark spider of a storm, brooding over the valley of Jovel, like the memory of what was to come. In Lima, over Pisco Sours, Samuel told me of the 14 lost years he left behind in prison. He was still a Tupamaro, would be one until his final breath. There was nothing else he could be after they took everything else away. 14 years, his hair turned white. They beat him at first with hoses. The darkness closed in. There was nothing to read. His family stopped coming one by one. He survived only because he was a Tupamaro, because he remembered what that meant. even if remembering is against the law. In Uruguay now, in Chile, it is official. There is no memory. You are not allowed to remember the bad times. They are over, and the rememberers have been ordered by the commissions of oblivion under penalty of law to forget. Juan Helman refuses to forget. They took his son, his daughter-in-law, his soon-to-be-born grandchild, all the way down to La Realidad on our way to the Zapatista Convention. He told me of his long search, recorded in 10,000 sleepless nights, 10,000 poems that can never rest until his unborn grandchild is found. It is official, too, in Argentina today, this forgetfulness. It is forbidden to remember who it is you are looking for. But Juan Helman will never let go. We are their memory, he turns to me. If we forget them now, then those who have been taken will never have existed. In my own country, amnesia is the norm. The schools teach us to unremember from birth, the slave takings, the risings up, the songs of resistance, the first May 1st, our martyrs from Haymarket to Attica to the redwoods of California, ripped whole from our hearts, erased from official memory. When we die, there will be no trace. Here too, in these green hills, in the free territories of Ovantique and Palo, they will try and make us forget the mass graves, the babies ripped from the wombs, the wounded families and villages, the languages they speak. They will shrug and say, it never happened. It is written down nowhere. No pasa nada aquí, señor. They will dig up the bones and pound them down to powder and lose the powder in the four winds, but like Juan Helman, Samuel, the others, the Indians will never give up, will never abandon the memory of their dead, never leave the past behind, because the past will never go away. The past is like a boomerang. It will always return. It is always present. It is always future. It is the most fundamental human right, memoria, what belongs to us all.
John Ross, author of The War Against Oblivion. If you'd like to order a cassette copy of this program, 1-800-926-3921. Democracy Now! in Exile is produced by Chris Abrams, Lizzie Ratner, and Jeremy Scahill. Thanks to Rachel Jones, Chase Pearson, and Rachel Jones as well. Democracy Now! Is broadcasting in exile from the embattled studios of WBAI, the studios of The Band and the Fire, the studios of our listeners. Jackie Suen is our webmaster. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening. Vamos a andar para llegar. From Ground Zero Radio, this is Democracy Now! In Exile.
As the U.S. war against terrorism begins to spread, there's almost certainly more unrest about to appear throughout the region. So far from closing things down, U.S. power is likely, I think, to be stirring them up in ways that can't always be contained.
Professor Edward Said and Noam Chomsky usher in the new year for Democracy Now! In Exile. All that and more coming up. Welcome to the War and Peace Report, broadcasting just blocks from the first Ground Zero. Afghanistan is the second. I'm Amy Goodman. Happy New Year. 2001 was a year that saw the world's richest country attacking one of the world's poorest. Since October, thousands of Afghans have perished at the hands of U.S. bombs. The country remains littered with unexploded cluster munitions, some of which are identical in color to the Pentagon's so-called humanitarian food rations. So when kids run out to grab some food, they don't know whether it's a cluster bomb. In Kabul, a new Washington-backed government has replaced the Taliban. This government, hailed as the first step toward a democratic Afghanistan, is made up largely of warlords, many of them documented human rights violators, some of them accused by major human rights groups of conducting mass executions of thousands of civilians over the last decade. And despite the change of government to one publicly favored by Washington, the U.S. bombing continues. Just this past weekend, U.S. warplanes attacked villages in eastern Afghanistan, reportedly killing some 100 civilians. These victims in the Bush administration's war against Afghanistan join the more than 4,000 civilians killed in U.S. attacks. But according to almost every source in the media and government, Taliban leader Mullah Mohammed Omar is still alive. Osama bin Laden recently appeared on yet another video. Well, the Bush administration continues to admit it has no clue of where he is. Though George Bush did not say that killing of thousands of civilians in Afghanistan is one of the goals of a so-called war on terror, it seems to be what he's most successful doing. Today, on the War and Peace Report, we're going to kick off this new year by looking more closely at the Bush administration's war on the world and what it might bring in 2002. We have two speeches. We will go to Professor Edward Said, but first to Noam Chomsky.
Another consequence of the collapse of the deterrent is that there's no space left for independence and non-alignment. And in fact, the non-aligned movement essentially collapsed at that point. One indication of the collapse of this concern is the very sharp decline in foreign aid in the decade that followed. In the United States, declined to virtually zero. There's no longer any need for it for essentially propaganda purposes. And the effects of this were recognized very quickly. So President Mahathir of Malaysia, for example, pointed out right away. He said, paradoxically, the greatest catastrophe for us who had always been anti-communist is the defeat of communism. The end of the Cold War has deprived us of the only leverage we had, the option to defect. Now we can turn to no one, and there is furthermore no deterrent. And those fears were expressed very clearly throughout the South. The Gulf War, which followed very quickly, it was bitterly condemned throughout the South as a needless show of force designed to demonstrate that what we say goes. Recall George Bush's words as the bombs and the missiles were falling. In this case, too, there's good reason to suppose that that there were peaceful alternatives, diplomatic alternatives were available, and there's, in fact, good reason to suppose that the Bush administration was feared that they might become difficult to suppress. The media cooperated nicely. The general mood in the South at that time was captured rather well by Cardinal Paulo Evarista Arns of São Paulo, Brazil. He said that, correctly, that in the Arab countries, the rich sided with the U.S. government, while the millions of poor condemned this military aggression, joining the ignored Iraqi opposition, he could have added. Throughout the Third World, he continued, there is hatred and fear. When will they decide to invade us, and on what pretext? The reaction to the bombing of Serbia was very much the same throughout the world. Again, there's quite compelling evidence that peaceful options were available that might have spared plenty of misery. But it was bitterly condemned throughout the world, even in U.S. allies, U.S. client states like Israel. Leading military analysts simply dismissed it as a show of return to the gunboat diplomacy of the last century, cloaked by the same hypocrisy. Well, Americans are very carefully protected from any of this. We're protected from world opinion and protected from critical discussion. So to really work to find out any of these things. But we don't do ourselves any favors by keeping to these restrictions. And we also do ourselves no favors by ignoring the public documents that explain very clearly the thinking of planners about the world that they're creating, and they have overwhelming power to create. They understand very well, as we should, that the world is what's called tripolar in economic terms. That is, there are roughly comparable centers of economic power in Asia, Europe, and North America. But the world is radically unipolar in the capacity to destroy, to resort to violence and destroy. The United States already outspends the next 15 countries for what's called defense, and defense, as always, means offense. And it's far ahead in military technology. And the current plans, as you all know, are to sharply increase that disparity. That includes extending the arms race into space, which means demolishing the Outer Space Treaty that's been observed for since 1967. Ballistic missile defense is only a small part of this, and even that is well understood to be an offensive weapon, not a defensive weapon. It's understood by adversaries, it's understood by strategic analysts here. So the RAND Corporation, for example, describes the BMD as an enabler of action, not a shield. Strategic analysts say the same thing. In fact, they applaud the program typically as a means to establish U.S. global hegemony. And they explain that that's what the world needs. I won't quote it since I've just been warned to shut up, but it's interesting comments. Which have many. They just mimic many predecessors. You know, all of this is totally familiar for hundreds of years. They explain very clearly that the far broader program of militarization of space, that's also explained very clearly and quite intelligently in perfectly public documents, no reason not to know them. They point out that this is the Space Command, that this is the natural next step in expanding state power. So armies and then navies were established in order to protect commercial interests and investment. And the next obvious frontier is space, for the same reasons, to protect commercial interests and investment. However, they point out there's going to be a difference this time. The British had a huge navy for that purpose, but it was possible to counter it. Germany could develop a navy. Don't have to talk about the consequences. This case is going to be different. Now, this arms race is going to have only one competitor running, and just like now. And there will be a sole hegemon. The United States is going to be so awesomely powerful that there won't be any counterforce. That's, first of all, necessary for just plain technical reasons. The whole space war system is based on satellites, and satellites are very easy to shoot down. They're not like missiles. So you have to make sure that no adversary has the poor man's weapon, anti-satellite weapons, and that requires overwhelming dominance of space, which is understood and intended. And there's another reason. The other reason is that what they call globalization is expected to lead to a widening divide between the haves and the have-nots. That's an assessment that's shared by U.S. intelligence and others. Notice that's contrary to the theories that you're supposed to believe in. But it's quite in accord with practice. And it's going to be necessary, they conclude reasonably, to control the unruly elements. Now, how do you do that? Well, by inspiring fear or by actual use of highly destructive killing machines launched from space, laser weapons, probably nuclear powered, on a hair trigger automated alert system, which is a virtual guarantee of what are called normal accidents, meaning the kinds of accidents that will always take place unpredictably in complex systems. It's recognized that these programs significantly increase the danger of unimaginable catastrophe, but that too is entirely rational. It's important to recognize that. It's entirely rational within the framework of prevailing institutions and ideology. The principle is that hegemony just ranks a lot higher than survival. That's ample precedents for that right through the Cold War. Easy to give examples, and well before. The only difference is that by now the stakes are far higher, the survival of the species, and that's no exaggeration. Well, these are some of the prospects if current tendencies persist, but there is no reason at all for this to happen. There is good news. The good news is that the reigning system of authority is very fragile, and they know it. There's a major effort right now, as you're aware, to exploit the current mood of anguish and fear in order to ram through harsh, regressive, dangerous programs. Militarization of space is only one. And in order to, and it's being used to deflect the mass popular movements that have been taking shape in unprecedented and highly encouraging ways. But there's no reason at all to succumb to those efforts. There's every reason not to. There are plenty of choices and options available. What's needed, as always, is will and dedication to pursue them.
Professor Noam Chomsky. He teaches linguistics at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, and his latest book, Omen Many, is 911. And by the way, if you want to get a copy of this videotape that includes the upcoming speaker, Edward Said, as well as John Ross talking about the Zapatistas, you can call 1-800-926-3921 for a videotape of all three on this New Year's. 1-800-926-3921. As we turn now to Professor Edward Said, who recently gave a speech in the middle of the U.S. bombing of Afghanistan. Again, we were talking about the numbers, more than 4,000 civilians killed in the U.S. attacks on Afghanistan. If these numbers shock you, it may be because the University of New Hampshire professor Mark Herold, who's documenting the death toll, his report has been kept off the pages of U.S. media. I believe it's only been reported in the Guardian newspaper in London. They've covered these findings. And if you want to go to our website at democracynow.org, that's democracynow.org, you'll see the latest report. We are going to go to Professor Said after a break for stations to identify themselves. You're listening to the War and Peace Report. Stay with us.
Six above sea level. I grab the mic because I like to take you to another mental level. Low power frequency radio modulation. The big sound from underground, another pirate station. We bring the truth to places truth is never heard before. We bring the sound communication of our tribal war. Dark vision fly by helicopters in the night. Attempt triangulation of our station in the fight. Straight from the base, deep down, low precision. High crime treason, we broadcast in sedition. Like the Wall Street Morning Afternoon Edition. Commandeering airwaves from unknown positions. Live and direct, we come and never pre-recorded. With information that would never be reported. Disregard the mainstream, media distorted. We come and listener supported. Live and direct, we come and never pre-recorded.
Listener supported. Michael Franti here on the War and Peace Report. This is Resistance Radio. I'm Amy Goodman. As we turn now to Professor Edward Said, he teaches comparative literature at Columbia University and gave this speech just a few weeks ago.
I'd like to speak about the general situation in which we find ourselves after September the 11th, and then I want to focus specifically on the Middle East. As somebody from West Asia, I'm pleased to be addressing a forum organized by South Asians, and since I don't believe in artificial divisions of that sort, nevertheless, perhaps geographical identifications are not useless all the times. But as a child of war myself, having been born into a war contest, being an adolescent in one, and then maturing in others, I've always felt that wars are never a solution. They seem to often beget other wars, as was the case with World War II, which produced colonial wars elsewhere, and certainly in my part of the world, we've had our share of those, plus, of course, civil wars, insurgencies, and so on. So I think the general situation of belligerency, can you hear me well or not? No, sorry about that. Yeah. Yes, louder. Is this better? Right. I was simply saying that wars have always, you know, seemed to me to produce other wars, and they really are deeply unsatisfactory solutions to problems that and issues that arise and seem inevitably to lead to war, such as September the 11th. I don't think this is an exception, the war that we're in now and other wars that we may be heading towards. A few days ago, I received a letter from an admired friend of mine, a retired professor of history, who is certainly one of the greatest scholars produced in this country. In his letter, he wrote me the following: "In the current madness of our nation and the world, it seems determined to conquer. It seems to me that never in the many political crises that I've experienced, beginning with the Wallace campaign, have I felt so pessimistic about the country and so impotent. There seems to be no stirring of a movement, no social and cultural base from which an opposition could grow. The way in which Sharon is imitating Bush to eliminate the Palestinian government and consolidate Israeli domination, with nothing but anti-colonial men of desperation left to express the aspirations of the Palestinian, of the Palestinians, it is too horrendous. I wait for the U.S. to invade Iraq next." Now, these are certainly sentiments that I share in many ways, and that many of us who are Americans from the Islamic and Arab world also share. There's no point here in stressing what everybody in the world has already stressed endless times, that the dreadful September 11th terrorist attacks have had a profound effect not only on the city where we all live and which so many of us have found to be a refuge from an old world of war and misery, as well as a superb place to work and study and teach and bring up children, but also it's had terrible effects on the world, not at all in finally salutary ways. There's no need at all now for me to try to compete patriotically with all the uncounted zillions of words that have been uttered or written expressing shock, outrage, anger, sorrow at the events of September the 11th. But there is a need, I think, to go beyond and think reflectively and critically, something which, alas, the present environment hasn't been so hospitable to. As a nation, we risk, I think, entering into an anti-democratic triumphalist phase, and this, which is huge power unopposed or unchallenged on grounds of fear or of angering the majority or of seeming unpatriotic, this would be a national and moral catastrophe of great proportions. We need always to be asking ourselves what events mean, what they represent, and who and what any particular speaker represents, who and what constituency, and for what purpose and interest they speak for. That is the type of debate which is the real health of democracy to which we must all remain committed. Now, as a deeply secular intellectual who has always suspected and made clear my disagreement and discomfort with religious politics, I find that the current war, not just against terrorism, which must always be critically analyzed and distinguished into types and kinds, but against what has been characterized vaguely as a kind of metaphysical evil, has been an extremely problematic one. First of all, because as Americans, we have taken on the role of righteous avengers, which with the enormous military and political and economic power wielded by the US has made for scenes of awful destruction and unforeseen circumstances all over the world, as well, of course, as creating vast new abstractions both to be for and to be against. Islam and the West, or America, I've said repeatedly, are generalizations I find difficult to follow blindly. I'm not one of the people, though, who ever had any time for Islamists or fundamentalists. or the religious right anywhere that they have fought. They have brought nothing but deception, disappointment, tragedy, and waste wherever they've preached their gospel of indiscriminate war, in the case of the Islamists, against the Kuffar. And I have no regret in seeing the demise of the Taliban regime and the Al-Qaeda. But I think it's incumbent on us to have equally critical assessments of all so-called faith-based politics, whether in the Muslim world or elsewhere. Bombing abortion clinics and preventing the teaching of evolution on religious grounds are as reprehensible here as imprisoning or abusing women at home there, and for that matter, discriminating against non-majority religions in places, whether like Saudi Arabia or Israel, where I think such practices have to be opposed. The trouble with the present time, though, is that majority opinion seems to be represented not only by the government, which in its search for unity must appear to speak with one voice, I suppose, but also all or most of the other voices, those of the media in particular. I have found that this idea of unity, the political image that the government and the media, which has acted mostly without independence from the government, is what is being projected now. There really is a feeling being manufactured by the media and the government that a collective we exists, and that we all act and feel together, as witnessed perhaps by such unimportant surface phenomena as flag flying and the use of the collective we by journalists in describing events all over the world in which the US is involved. We bombed, we said, we decided, we acted, we feel, we believe, etc., etc. Of course, this is only marginally to do with the reality, which is far more complicated and far less reassuring. There's plenty of unrecorded or unregistered uncertainty and skepticism, I think, lots of questioning, even outspoken dissent here and there, but it seems hidden by overt patriotism. So American unity is being projected with such force as to allow very little questioning of US policy, which in many ways is heading towards a series of more complex events after Afghanistan, the meaning of which many people will not realize until far too late. In the meantime, American unity needs to state to the world that what America does and has done cannot brook serious disagreement or discussion. Just like bin Laden, Bush tells the world, you are either with us or you are with terrorism and hence against us. So on the one hand, America is not at war with Islam, but only with terrorism. And on the other hand, in complete contradiction with that, since only America decides who or what Islam and terrorism are, we are against Muslim terrorism and Islamic rage as we define them. I've been astonished at how much cant and zeal and phony expertise there has been on the media, with a few exceptions. I mean, I've never seen a situation quite like this one. Leaving aside all the military expert, or as The Economist has called them, all the justly retired military analysts, the experts on Islam, people like the ever so arrogant and vulgar Thomas Friedman with his dreadful letters. I'm going to come back to him in a minute. As well as the ponderously vindictive and shallow Fuad Ajami and Daniel Pipes and the extraordinarily falsehood-mongering Bernard Lewis. I wish I had time to go over some of the stuff he says in that article he did a couple of months ago in The New Yorker, which I don't read anymore. All of them have been unanimous in their shallow generalizations, their gratuitous, uncritical repetition of cliches, their unhelpful and uninformed denunciations of a world that they have willfully turned into essentially a satellite of Osama bin Laden's crazed mind. There are, we need to remind ourselves, there are 1.3 billion Muslims in the world. There are many, many languages, many traditions, many peoples, many histories. all of them claiming to be Muslim, but none of them is collapsible into things like rage or militancy or extremism. Then there's the, to go back to Friedman for a second, and I don't really want to waste too much time on him, but I mean, he keeps repeating this ridiculous thing about how Islam needs a reformation. Well, how many reformations were there? There was one. Spain never had a reformation. Why doesn't Spain get preached at for having produced the ETA terrorists? And besides, Friedman is so ignorant, I don't think he would recognize a reformation if he saw one walking down the street. He just keeps saying, what Islam needs is a reformation. What Islam needs is more people, and he quotes some letters from some Pakistani or some Saudi Arabia, writing about how unhappy he or she happens to feel. But, you know, the funny part of it is he never seems to turn his critical, I guess you could call it critical or critical vulgarity and arrogance, on himself or on the United States. What about a reformation here for change? I mean, it's always somewhere else. And he keeps saying, I saw him once on television saying, these people have to be reminded, I guess he's referring to Kuwait perhaps, I don't know. He says they have to be reminded that we liberated them. I'm not quite sure what follows from that, but perhaps gratitude. But the idea of criticism is always extended out from pundits like Friedman, who seem to be speaking for and representing some larger humanity than anybody's aware of. Then we have the pundits like Samuel Huntington, Fukuyama, and Farid Zakaria, another recently found oracle to which people turned. I was given, as a kind of malicious present by my wife, a special issue of Newsweek entitled The Davos Issue, which is a kind of heavyweight, punditry, you know, laden issue of the magazine with articles by people like the ones I mentioned, Fukuyama, Huntington, and the others. And what was interesting about it to me was not that everything in it was expected. You could predict line after line what they were saying, but how respectable professors like Huntington and Rand or CIA analysts like Fukuyama, who's I guess now a professor also, were making vast generalizations without about Islam and about the world we live in, without any proof, as if the normal canons of rational argument in which you state a proposition and then, you know, give examples of what you mean and prove it. All that was thrown out. You didn't need to. Islam was demented, or Islam was angry at modernity, or Islam is the only religion that isn't tolerant, as if, I mean, show me a tolerant religion and I'll happily join it. But so all of these people are all the time on the media, and as I say, there's never much thoughtfulness or self-criticalness. At the same time, it's quite apparent to me that the journalists, as well as these experts, have been adjuncts of the military. Now, with a successful defeat, it seems, of the Taliban, most of whom, as the journalistic expression has it, seem to have faded away just as they faded into existence, they faded out of existence, no doubt to join the Northern Alliance. There is now the menacing prospect, according to Bruce Anderson of The Independent on December the 10th, I quote him, of a confident America which is now choosing its next targets. Despite great, indeed unparalleled power as Americans, we need to be aware, I think, of other people in the world besides ourselves. And I cite a statistic which is often cited, that we constitute about 5 or 6% of the world, and we consume in population, and we consume 30% of the world's oil, which seems to be our God-given right. Despite the badgering and the flag-waving and Lynn Cheney's list of 117 un-Americans, it strikes me as very American, on the other hand, to be asking critical questions about war, peace, and U.S. involvement in the world. One of the things to be remembered is that the U.S. has played a very considerable role during the 70s and the 80s, and even in the 60s, and even in the 50s that I can recall, of aiding and arming Islamic movements. I don't mean this as a way of excusing the terrorism of September the 11th, but rather as a way of wisely preventing a recurrence of knowing history for its own sake. I think one ought not to take one's eye away, as the media soon will, from Afghanistan, where desperation, the enormous numbers of refugees, and poverty and the ruins of a society capped after 20 years of war, you know, will be feeling the brunt of the disasters of the last 3 months that have been heaped on the 3 months heaped on the place. And I don't think that it's a good model to follow, that in other words, you encourage an insurgency as we did in the 1980s against the Soviet Union, and then you leave it alone, and then it comes back, then you go back and bomb it. And it can't be assuaged or taken care of with free market economics, which have failed in places like Egypt and Pakistan. I think one has to recall that people can be, and this you never see a reference to, I think, anywhere, but I think you have to remember that people can be moved and mobilized by a sense of injustice when people lose their land or their livelihood, or to be dispossessed, and that it's not, all of these things don't necessarily lead to a whole bunch of fundamentalist extremists. I think people can be and are moved and mobilized by injustice and a hope of justice. And I think it's also important to remember that Islam is not unlike Judaism and Christianity in producing militants who do violent action on behalf of their cause. There are plenty of examples in this country, in Israel, in other parts of the world, to show what I mean. So I think there's a tremendous need for critical understanding and a certain kind of compassion as well. I think it's never the wrong time to understand the narratives of sufferings, of suffering that produce desperation and violence. And this kind of understanding is not, as it's frequently referred to, with a great sort of dismissal and contempt. This is not victimology, but human reality in the most profound sense of that phrase. I want to turn now from the general situation to one specific situation, namely the Middle East, which during the course of the war against terrorism since September the 11th, both the U.S. government in the persons of the President and Colin Powell, Secretary of State, and the British government in the person of persons of Blair and Jack Straw, the foreign minister, have made specific reference to the need for a Palestinian state. In the meantime, as something important, you know, to keep the coalition together. In the meantime, the situation on the ground, partly as a result of September the 11th, but you know, going back in time way before it, has gotten worse. And what I'd like now to spend the rest of the time doing is talking about the situation in Palestine as a quite different situation from that of Afghanistan. I wanted to remind you that there is a wonderful poem written in 1982, which by the leading Palestinian poet Mahmoud Darwish. It's a poem that begins, "The world," and he wrote it, I should mention, in September of 1982, "The world is closing in on us, pushing us through the last passage, and we tear off our limbs to pass through." Then he says, "Where shall we go after the last frontiers? Where should the birds fly after the last sky?" I use that line, "after the last sky," as the title of a book I wrote in 1986 with a photographer, Jean Moore. It's now 19 years later. It's 2001. The Palestinian situation is much the same as it was in 1982, although it's worse because it's happening in Palestine, not Lebanon. Once again, Ariel Sharon and his military have surrounded an overwhelmingly civilian population of Palestinians. This time, they're besieged and imprisoned inside the West Bank and Gaza, which is occupied by Israel since 1967. Of which 28% of the West Bank and 60% of Gaza have been allowed Palestinians since the Oslo process. The rest of the land has been taken over by 400,000 Israeli settlers in 145 settlements, including those on Palestinian land around Jerusalem. Since the Intifada began last September, Palestinians have been shut up by the Israeli military in villages, towns, cities, and farms into no less than 220 discontinuous little ghettos, blockaded, imprisoned for 15 straight months, in addition to curfews inside the towns from time to time, often for weeks at a stretch. No one, young or old, sick or well, dying or pregnant, student or doctor, can move without going through hours at the barricades manned by rude and purposely humiliating Israeli military searches. At this moment, 200 Palestinians are unable to receive kidney dialysis just because the Israeli military won't allow them to go to medical centers because of security reasons. There must be thousands and thousands of young Israeli conscripts who are abusing an entire population like this for months on end, with only a few refusing this demeaning and sadistic service. And one question that comes to mind, have any of the legions of foreign media personnel who cover the conflict, which is about as one-sided as any in history, have any of them done a story about these brutalized young Israelis trained chiefly to punish Palestinian civilians collectively as the main part of their military duty in the name of the Jewish people on the land of Israel? Compare this, please, with the enormously well-covered sins of the fundamentalist Taliban. As the Islamic Conference Foreign Ministers emergency meeting opened on December the 10th in Qatar, Yasser Arafat was not allowed by Israel to leave his office in Ramallah. His speech was read by an aide. 15 miles away from Ramallah in Gaza, the airport and the two aging Palestinian helicopters were destroyed a week earlier by Israeli planes and bulldozers, with, this is very important, with no one and no force to check, much less prevent, the daily tank incursions by Israel, of which this particular feat of military daring was a part. Gaza Airport is the only airport, is the only rather port of entry directly into Palestinian territory, and the only civilian airport in the world destroyed wantonly since World War II. Periodically, Israeli F-16s, generously supplied by the United States, have bombed and strafed, Guernica-style, Palestinian towns and villages. These, by the way, jets were never used by South African apartheid to bomb the townships in South Africa under apartheid. They're used regularly by Israel against Palestinians in their towns and villages, during which, of course, vast amounts of property are destroyed and lost, many civilians and police officials killed. There is no Palestinian army or navy or air force, and certainly no air or any other kind of defense to protect the people, and all of this is done at will. Apache attack helicopters, again supplied by the U.S., have missile murdered 77 Palestinian leaders, allegedly for terrorist offenses, past or future, with a group of unknown Israeli intelligence operatives holding decision-making powers for these assassinations, presumably also approved by the cabinet and, of course, by the U.S., which has tacitly approved of the practice of self-defense. The helicopters have also done an efficient job of bombing Palestinian Authority installations, police as well as civilian. During the night of December 5th, the Israeli army entered the five-story offices of the Palestinian Central Bureau of Statistics in Ramallah, carried off the computers, every file and every report, then destroyed the building in an act of theft and vandalism designed to efface as many of the significant traces of collective Palestinian life as possible. In 1982, the same army under the same commander entered West Beirut, carted off documents and files from the Palestinian Research Center, then flattened the structure. A few days later came the massacres of Sabra and Shatila. The suicide bombers of Hamas and Islamic Jihad have, of course, been at work, as Sharon knew perfectly well that they would, since after a 10-day lull in the fighting in late November, Sharon suddenly ordered the murder of a Hamas leader, a man called Mustafa Abu Hannoud, an act quite designed quite consciously to provoke Hamas into retaliation and then enable his armies to resume their butchery of Palestinians.
Professor Edward Said giving a speech in the midst of the bombing of Afghanistan. He teaches comparative literature at Columbia University. If you would like to get a copy of the speech, we're going to go back to it in just a minute, you can call 1-800-926-3921. It's a videotape that includes Noam Chomsky, Edward Said, as well as John Ross talking about the Zapatistas. We're going to go to a break and then back to Professor Said.
Justice. No justice, no peace. I say, no justice.
No justice for the people. No peace.
Oh, no justice for the people.
No justice.
No
peace.
No justice.
No justice for the people. No peace.
They think the revolution died when the black.
You are listening to the War and Peace Report as we return to Professor Edward Said.
But I think one has to look at the Sharonian view of the world, which has no place in it at all for Palestinians or for Arafat, whom he has been calling all sorts of terrible names for the past several years. Partly, I think, because Sharon has no ideas as such, and partly because of his immense bulk, he finds it therefore natural to do what he has always done, kill Palestinians, either by the bullet or by stifling them, the way a large pachyderm does to nasty little animals that happen to be there. Sharon has always held, this is very important, I think, also to understand, that Sharon has always held the notion that by dispensing with Arafat, he can then make a series of independent agreements with local warlords, rather the way the British in 19th century Africa came to understandings with docile chiefs. He tried it in 1982 in Lebanon. The idea was to invade Lebanon, destroy the PLO, and put in place a president, a Lebanese president, Bashir Ismail, who would then be an ally, who was an ally, of the Israelis. The trouble with that was, of course, that nobody else wanted to play with him, and the day after he was made president, Bashir Ismail was assassinated, after which the massacres of Sabra and Shatila and the whole place fell apart. And, you know, 18 years later, the Israelis were driven from Lebanon. But by doing what they've been doing and dividing about 40% of the West Bank and most of Gaza into several non-contiguous cantons whose borders are controlled by the Israeli army, Sharon dreams thus to have subdued the Palestinian and satisfied his supposed constituency. How this is supposed to gain Israel a sense of safety and security eludes me, but not, alas, the ones with the relevant power. I think in conclusion, what I want to say is that this kind of cycle, as it's been referred to very often in the press, is going absolutely no place, but the people who are paying the price are the Palestinians, the weaker ones. And none of this would happen, and this is the final point I want to make, we can then open the ground to the floor to question and discussion, is that none of this would be possible without the backing of the United States. That is to say, Israel has been the recipient of the largest amount of foreign aid of any country in the history of foreign aid. Since 67, over $95 billion. And it's a matter of honor that every politician has to celebrate Israel and the security of Israel and the correctness of everything Israel does to survive in American politics. The same applies to the media, with the solid exception and the sole exception of a magazine like The Nation. It's virtually impossible to be critical of Israel in the major press, in the major media, All you have to do is look at the pages of the New York Times and the Washington Post to take two very simple cases, and you'll see exactly what I mean. And the tragedy of it is that the suffering of Palestinians has never even gained recognition in the public discourse of this country. And now I fear, and with this I want to conclude, and now I fear with the obsession with eradicating terrorism, with the near unanimity of discourse that exists in the media, with the danger of the war in Afghanistan spreading to other parts of obviously the Middle East, certainly Somalia, certainly Iraq are candidates for American invasion and bombing and the likes. And certainly there has been a great deal of pressure placed on the Palestinians to keep suppressing resistance in the name of fighting terrorism. The tragedy is likely to deepen, and the fate of the Palestinians is likely to get worse and worse. I think it's important to mention that the other Arabs and other Muslims have a vested interest in Arafat, despite their visible exasperation with him. But he's simply clever and more persistent than they are, and well knows the hold he has on the popular mind in their countries. As a devout and even pious Muslim, Arafat has had the foresight to cultivate two separate constituencies, the Islamists and the secular nationalists that exist throughout the Middle East and the Islamic world. Both exist, both constituencies exist, both feel under attack, even though the second one, the nationalist one, has been paid little attention to by the vast number of Western experts and Orientalists who've assumed that bin Laden is the paradigm-defining Muslim and not the much larger number of Muslim and non-Muslim secular Arabs who detest what bin Laden does and what he stands for. In Palestine, for example, the recent polls have found that Arafat and Hamas are now about equal in popularity, both hover between 20 and 25%, with, interestingly, with a majority of citizens favoring neither one nor the other. The same division, with the same significant plague on both your houses' majority, exists in the Arab countries, where the reductiveness and unacceptable and sometimes very violent Islam of the religious groups, most of whom are more interested in the regulation of personal behavior than they are in matters like globalization, producing electricity, and more jobs. And people are also disgusted with the corruption, brutality, and dependence of the regime that have turned most of the people off. I think what one learns from this is that one can be religious without being an Islamist, and conversely, one can be secular without being a Spinozist atheist. Most analyses today scant such distinctions, but they are, I think, valid ones. In such a volatile atmosphere, therefore, Arabs and Muslims might very well turn against their own rulers in all sorts of unwelcome ways, were Arafat seen as being literally choked to death by Israeli violence and Arab indifference. So Arafat is necessary to the present landscape, although I'm also convinced that were a new collective Palestinian leadership to emerge from the mess of today, especially if it were of a younger generation than Arafat, Arafat's departure would seem more like a natural inevitability than either a betrayal or an Israeli murder. When that might happen is impossible to tell, but that it will happen is, I think, a certainty. As for the Europeans and the Americans, well, to put it bluntly, I don't think they really know what they're doing. Most of them would gladly be rid of Palestine as a problem, and in the spirit of Bush and Powell, would not be happy if the vision of a Palestinian state were somehow realized so long as someone else did it. Besides, they would find it very hard to function with the Middle East, in the Middle East, if they didn't have Arafat to blame, snub, insult, prod, and pressure to. To me, the mission, the senseless mission of both the EU and General Zinni, who looked completely out of place in Gaza, will of course have no effect at all on Sharon and his people, who have concluded correctly that the Westerners are on their side basically and they can go on doing what they do best. Arafat and his peoples begging to please come and negotiate, notwithstanding. Nobody much listens to Arafat these days. The slowly emerging group of Palestinians in Palestine and in the diaspora that I mentioned earlier, the secular nationalists, is beginning to learn and use tactics that solidly place a moral onus on the West and Israel to come to terms with the issue of Palestinian rights, not just of the Palestinian presence. In Israel, for example, an audacious Knesset member, a man called Azmi Bshara, has been stripped of his parliamentary immunity and is on trial and will be soon on trial for incitement to violence. Why? Because he has long stood for the Palestinian right of resistance to occupation. And at the same time, he's argued that Israel should be the state of all of its citizens, like every other state in the world, not just of the Jewish people. For the first time, a major Palestinian challenge on the basis of rights to citizenship and struggle for those rights is being mounted inside Israel, not on the West Bank, with all eyes on the proceedings. At the same time, an important case against Sharon's war crimes has been suggested for trial in a Belgian court by the state attorney's office. And this, plus a certain failure of his policies, will bring him down as it always has in the past. In my opinion, Sharon is a born loser. A painstaking mobilization of secular Palestinian opinion is also taking place as we gather here this evening. And this, I think, will slowly overtake the Palestinian Authority and its remnant, despite continued Israeli attacks and widespread Palestinian disarray. The moral high ground is, in the end, I think, inevitably, going to be seized back from Israel as the focus and occupation become central, and as more and more Israelis realize that there's no way in the end to keep even a 35-year-old occupation going on and on indefinitely. Besides, as the US war against terrorism begins to spread, there's almost certainly more unrest about to appear throughout the region. So far from closing things down, US power is likely, I think, to be stirring them up in ways that can't always be contained. It's no mean irony that the renewed focus on Palestine was a link made by the US and the Europeans as a way of keeping the anti-Afghanistan coalition together. Watch for more of this as the months roll on in Palestine and elsewhere. And I'll stop here. Thank you.
And that was Professor Edward Said, university professor at Columbia in New York. He teaches comparative literature, has written many books, speaking recently in the midst of the bombing of Afghanistan. Before that, we brought you Noam Chomsky. He's author of the book 9-1-1. Noam Chomsky, professor of linguistics at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. If you'd like to get a videotape of the two speeches, as well as the speech that we did in our first hour of John Ross, author of The War Against Oblivion, which is about the Zapatistas, you can get all three speeches on one videotape, our New Year's videotape, if you call 1-800-926-3921. That's 1-800-926-3921. You can also get information about the program at our website, democracynow.org, and all sorts of ways you can be a part of this listener-sponsored experiment. And as we move into this new year, just again, I want to thank everyone who has been there for us and made it possible for us to broadcast this largest public media collaboration in the country. In the last months, thanks to KPFA and KFCF, despite a ban by Pacifica Foundation, which has been lifted this past weekend, and it looks like we'll be back on all five Pacifica stations, as well as all of the affiliates like yours have been so loyal in running us. We have been broadcasting on public access TV stations around the country, thanks especially to Manhattan Neighborhood Network in New York. We've been broadcasting on channels 34 and 56 every day. We want to thank WFMU that really stepped up to the plate. And at a time when we weren't able to broadcast at our home station, WBAI, WFMU has been there every night, 7 o'clock. You can hear us, and we hope we'll continue to be able to hear us at 91.1 FM in New York. York. Easy to remember. It is 911. We've also been broadcasting on shortwave radio, Radio for Peace International. I have friends in Honduras who've been saying they've been listening every day. On the internet, thanks to Errol Maitland and Reem Karhuda at WBIX.org, which is WBAI in exile, twice a day. Also at our website, democracynow.org. And thanks to Free Speech TV that broadcasts us on their 24-hour channel on Dish Network. That's channel 9415 of the Dish Network. And we hope whatever way you listen to us or watch us that you will let us know by emailing us at mail@democracynow.org. We're looking for all sorts of ways to keep our communication system going. If you can help out, perhaps your office is upgrading. We're looking for Sony PD150 video cameras. We go out now not only with tape recorders, but with video cameras. That's Sony PD150 video cameras. Looking again for Mac laptops as well, the latest G4 Titaniums, where we can also edit video. Just go to our website and you'll see all the information. You can also help us out by going to PayPal on our website. That's mail@democracynow.org. So many people to thank. Aaron Glantz and Amy Pomerleau at KPFA, Jim Bennett at KPFA, all the staff there, KFCF, Edwin Starr, who's been bringing us our music every day, our amazing staff, Chris Abrams and Lizzie Ratner, Miranda Kennedy and Brad Simpson. Jeremy Scahill has once again joined us. Anthony Sloan, our engineer and music maestro. And that's it. Welcome to the new year. It is a thrill to be with you all. We hope to be back on so many stations in the coming days. But we are still in exile from the embattled studios of WBAI and hope the band and Fired will be returned to those studios. We're in exile from the studios of our listeners and hope to be soon back there. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Democracy Now! In Exile. Happy New Year. Figure it out. Oh, stop the war now. Good God, hear me say, don't put it off another day. Also, a special thanks to our holiday crew of Chase Pearson, Jackie Suen, our webmaster, Rachel Jones, and so many, the video crew, Dee Dee Halleck and Karen Renucci, Orlando Richards and Molly Snyder-Fink, Emily Kunstler and Angela Alston, who have contributed every day to this program. Again, thank you. What do you think they'd say? I'm not trying to be funny. I'm just trying to get my point across. War is world's enemy number one, and it's time that we called it off.